We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program author of Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs, Johan Hari. Johan, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Sam. I'm really excited to be back with you. I think the interview I did with you was the first American interview I did about my book. So
it was. I still get emails, frankly, about that interview. It was, it was as the book was coming out. It has become a huge international success, and it seems like you have been doing one of the most protracted book tours I've ever heard of.
I keep ending up in these like bizarre places. Like one day I'll wake up and I'll be in like Colombia, and then I seem to be in Australia, and then it's just like a kind of bewildering. But I feel a warm haze of nostalgia talking to you, so I'm very happy.
Well, I appreciate you coming back, and of course, this is days before the UN General Assembly, which will be the first one since 1998. That deals with drugs. And before we get to that, I want to ask you, what, since writing the book, and I know the book was obviously it dealt with policy and broader issues, but I also know that it was a very personal experience for you. I'm curious, in the course of all your travels since writing the book and people reading it, has your perspective on what you wrote changed? Has your have you learned something that you would add in a sort of a second edition or a third edition of the book?
It's a really good question. I was trying to think about that the other day. I think there's a few things. I mean, there were things that I knew, but I'll give you an example. I was in Colombia about a month ago now, maybe a little bit more. And every time I spoke in Colombia, I tried to say at the start, the whole world owes Colombia a massive apology. You know, by imposing the war on drugs on them against their will, we have destroyed their country. More people have died in the drug war-related violence, by some estimates, in Colombia and Mexico than have died in Syria. And it was all preventable. None of that had to happen. In the same way that there is now no violence around the alcohol trade, right? There absolutely was under alcohol prohibition. There's now no violence around the trade at all. Everyone listening to this program knows who Al Capone or Pablo Escobar was, and I bet none of you know who the head of Smirnoff or Guinness are. And when I said that, I had this weird, you could really see people react. And at first I couldn't gauge it. I thought, in a way, did it seem almost offensive or condescending? And then someone said to in one of the Q&As, something like a quite young woman stood up and said, no one's ever said that to us. We've always thought that we were this terrible country that, you know, foisted drugs on the world. And no one's ever said that to us. And she looked quite shocked. And I think it really hit me again, something that I'd seen in my own family in a very different way. And I'd seen in many places, but it suddenly hit me how much the stigma flows all the wrong way in the drug war. You know, it flows towards addicts, towards drug users, and towards the supply route countries, towards the people caught up in the violence of the trade caused by prohibition, and not to the people it should flow towards, who are the people who keep this war going, even though they know it can't work, will never work, and is causing a lot more harm than good. So I guess emotionally, I really felt that. And I also felt that a lot. I guess that would be the theme in a lot of the ways people have reacted. If I think about, for example, one night in Baltimore, not long after we spoke, actually, I did an event where I talked about the book, and a woman came up to me afterwards and said, as you know, I should just explain to the listeners, we had drug addiction in my family. One of my earliest memories was of trying to wake up one of my relatives and not being able to. And I talk about one of the reasons why I went on the journey and traveled to so many different places and tried to understand the war on drugs was because I wanted to understand what happened to people that I love and to understand what would best help them. And a woman kind of came up to me and said something like, you know, she said, I have a brother who's got an addiction problem and I haven't seen him in 7 years. And I read your book and I'm taking him out for lunch next week. And I remember really feeling a kind of, oh, okay, this is before the book had been, you know, done well or anything. I just thought, oh, okay, it's worth it. It was worth writing this book. If that's the only effect it has. And you could really see again how she had internalized the shame and stigma. And she said, you know, I'm paraphrasing, I didn't write it down, but she said something like, you know, one of the things I realized is I shouldn't have been angry with him. I should have been angry with what was done to him.
That's fascinating. And that, I mean, that is, in many respects, I mean, that is the next step, right? I mean, from your, the thesis in your book is that it's, that we are, I mean, obviously looking at this in a completely, sort of almost a mirror image of the way that we should be looking at this as a problem. And, I imagine too, on your travels, you found that the, that there's not as much of that the dynamic that we see within the context of the drug war is at least fairly universal around the globe.
Yeah, that's one of the, apart from the countries that pursued the alternatives, which obviously I went to, Portugal, where they decriminalized all drugs with incredible results, Switzerland, where they legalized heroin with incredible results. Not a single person has died of an overdose on legal heroin in Switzerland in the 10 years it's been legal. And obviously Colorado, Washington, and Oregon, which are going to be very familiar to your listeners. With the exception of the, and Uruguay, with the exception of the countries that pursued the alternatives, one of the things that's most striking is, you know, I could rock up in Sydney, Frankfurt, I'm about to go to Paris, you know, the north of England, Los Angeles, Chicago, Baltimore. And although there are, of course, local differences, the core of it is the same. If you punish addicts, they get worse, not better. If you transfer the trade from legal businesses to armed criminal gangs, you trigger a war for drugs between those armed criminal gangs, which is extremely violent. The dynamic that the most despised groups, because you can't enforce the drug laws against everyone who breaks them, half of the population of the United States has broken them, obviously they end up getting enforced against the most easily picked on groups in that society. In Australia, it was Aboriginal people. In the United States, it's overwhelmingly African Americans. But you would see these dynamics play out in very similar ways across the world, which tells you something about how that war works.
Well, you know, it what didn't occur to me, and I think until I started, you know, reading about the UN's convention on drugs that's taking place on gas, as it's called, that there is a I guess much of this started with the UN's convention on narcotic drugs of 1961, but. How is it that there was this sort of like how is it that this disposition towards drugs has been near universal, or at least was for a certain period of time, right? I mean, like you say, there's a couple of examples that have sort of developed alternative perspectives on this, but what accounted for the near universality of this? Because, you know, I mean, we had prohibition in this country. It was a very failed experiment, but for the most part, you know, you didn't see that happen all around the world. Do you have a sense of like why there was this sort of near universality response to drugs?
It's an important question. I did a lot of digging into this, and the reason is kind of surprising. It's largely because it was forced upon the rest of the world by the US through a mixture of threats and bribes. I'll give you an example of a specific place to kind of explain it. So when the US banned drugs in 1914 and then continued banning some, so cannabis obviously was banned in the 30s, Mexico, the US, it failed, right? It didn't work. The drugs didn't disappear. And so there was this attempt to say, well, it's failing because not everyone has done it. And these, in fact, rhetoric that will sound very familiar to people because of what's going on in the presidential campaign, these disgusting Mexicans are responsible. We've got this open border with these cancerous Mexicans and we need to stop them. And if they're forced to do it, then the drugs will stop. So the story of what happened is kind of devastating. Mexico did a really brave thing, bearing in mind that they were a poor country, very dependent on trade with the United States. And, you know, the government's, you know, very dependent on the US. Mexican government said, no, we don't want to do this. It isn't going to work. We've looked at the results in the United States. It clearly doesn't work. It's a failed approach. And they appointed a man called Leopoldo Salazar Viniegra. When this war is over, we should be building statues to Leopoldo Salazar Viniegra. Mexico put him in charge of their drug policy. He was a doctor who ran the first rehab center in Mexico. And he said things that would seem visionary now. He said, we shouldn't ban cannabis because it's not particularly harmful. With other drugs, we need to respond with love and compassion. And we mustn't ban drugs because then Mexico will be taken over by armed criminal gangs. If any person has ever been vindicated by history, it's Leopoldo Salazar Viniegra. And Harry Anslinger, who was running the drug war, basically the founder of the modern drug war. We talked last time, I think, about the role he played in stalking and killing Billie Holiday, the great jazz singer. Harry Anslinger basically, and the US government basically said to Mexico, get rid of this man, he's got to go. And Mexico, again, very bravely said, no, we're going to determine our own policy. And so they made this escalating series of threats until in the end what they did is they cut off the supply of, so legal opiates for like hospitals, so painkillers for hospitals were manufactured in the United States. And what the US does, said, you're not getting any more painkillers until you fall into line. So they cut them off. So people started to die in agony in Mexican hospitals. And so obviously Mexico had to give in. And the whole course of Latin American history in the 20th century really branches at that point. If I think about the time I spent in Juarez and in northern Mexico, you know, as you know, I got to know a hitman for the deadliest Mexican drug cartel, a guy called Rosalio Reta, who between the ages of 13 and 17 butchered or beheaded about 70 people. If you think about the horror show that's happened to Mexico, it really begins at that moment, and none of it had to happen. Just like, as I said, as we were saying, you know, what happens to the violence around the alcohol trade? It ends the day alcohol prohibition ends.
Right.
This violence is entirely the product of prohibition. And this is one of the main reasons why. So you mentioned the UN meeting, and this is, I think, an incredibly exciting moment. So once every 10 years, the UN holds this big drug summit, and they basically say, you know, up to now it's happened once every 10 years, and all the countries of the world gather, and they basically, partly, not entirely, but partly due to this US pressure, basically commit to ridding the world of drugs. You mentioned, we were talking before we went on air about the official slogan of the last UNGAS, the last UN Drug Summit, was, do you want to say it?
Yeah, let me pull it up here. It was, I like saying it because it sounds like, I was telling you, it sounds like something I'd hear at my kids' preschool. A drug-free world. We can do it. I mean, I added the little lilt there, but we can do it. It is, I mean, that is like basically what you say, you know, as the ship is going down. Like, don't lose hope, everybody. There's a chance maybe we'll get gills or something. But this was, this is so, there's such a sort of like a, this is like an Up With People. I don't know if you know that reference, but just so one of these sort of like saccharine, encouraging things for high school teenagers. Like, hey, don't worry. This is just, I read this and I just laughed out loud. Apparently, not so much.
Well, what's fascinating is, so that has always been the message of every UN drug summit before. This is the first time in New York the meeting happens and significant numbers of countries are turning up and basically saying, we're not doing this bullshit anymore. This is crazy. It doesn't work. The alternatives do work. We've got to move to the alternatives. So one thing I've been doing over the last few months is talking to, I think, three of the most amazing people involved in representing their countries at the UNGAS, dissidents. I think they'll, in some ways, their arguments will be very familiar to American listeners. The reasons why the drug war is being rejected across the world are the reasons why the drug war is being rejected within the United States. And I think that these three guys, I wrote about them for the Los Angeles Times this weekend, I think are fascinating models of how we might think about this differently. So one of them, the representative of the Czech Republic, is a guy called Jindřich Vobaril. I apologize to anyone who speaks Czech who's listening to this because I know I'm saying that hideously wrongly. But he's their drugs minister. He's a really intriguing guy. So Jindřich basically grew up on the streets. He had a violent alcoholic father. So he spent most of his time on the streets. And when he was really quite young, when I think he was 11, he started kind of inhaling any substance he could get hold of. And as did lots of his friends, he was part of a kind of climate of street kids. And lots of his friends became addicted, lots of them died. He felt himself going down that path. The thing that pulled him out of it is that he became part of the resistance to the democratic underground that was a resistance to the communist dictatorship at the time. And that really gave him a sense of meaning. He became part of the punk scene. That really pulled him out of it. But when communism fell, he set up the first rehab center in the Czech Republic, and he wanted to follow the best evidence about what saves the lives of addicts. But what he discovered is a lot of the things that save the lives of addicts, like prescribing heroin, which Switzerland has done with incredible results, are illegal under the UN treaties. You're not allowed to do them. In fact, Chindra said to me when he heard that phrase, a drug-free world, we can do it, he thought of the Stalinist slogans he heard as a kid saying, like, no more greed.
Or, right, you know, yeah.
He said that's the only reference point he had. He said to me, if you put it in a different font, it would be a perfect Soviet slogan, you know, and just as realistic. So he's really, the thing that he'll be speaking out on at the UN is how the drug war is massively killing addicts all over the world, people with addiction problems.
I wanted to just mention at this point, which I don't know, and I certainly didn't realize, but we also, as in the United States, is a signatory to the Convention on Narcotic Drugs of 61. Apparently, Nixon in 1970 signed legislation implementing our national prohibition in compliance with that convention, called the Comprehensive Drug Abuse and Prevention and Control Act. So in some ways, I mean, this is all, how is it that, let's say, for instance, Switzerland, did they never sign this convention? I mean, I don't know exactly where we are in this country relative to, how much of this is a function of being in compliance with a UN convention, but is this the power of, I mean, is this why, and I want to hear about some of those other people that you spoke to, but is this the, is this at the foundation of the desire to change the UN policy on this?
It's a bit like the way the drug laws are enforced within the United States. If you live on the Upper East Side and your son has a drug problem, or even is just a casual drug user, he's not going to be arrested and he's not going to be sent to prison, right? If you're living in the South Bronx, there's a really big chance that they will. In the same way, rich countries can break the UN treaties with no consequences. Poor countries or middle-ranking countries can't. They get a punishment beating from the US and the other people who uphold the system. So Switzerland, for example, Switzerland had a big heroin problem. They legalized heroin for addicts, led by an incredible president who I got to know writing my book, Ruth Dreyfus, first female president of Switzerland, who's such an amazing, amazing person for many reasons. She explained to Swiss people, you know, when you hear the phrase legalization, what you think of is, you know, anarchy and chaos. What we have under the drug war is anarchy and chaos. We have unknown criminals selling unknown chemicals to unknown drug users, all in the dark, filled with violence, disease, and chaos. Legalization is how we restore order to that chaos. So what they did, obviously, legalization means different things for different drugs, and almost no one is in favor of going into the equivalent of CVS and just buying heroin. That's not how it works. I went to the heroin clinics in Switzerland. If you've got an addiction problem, you're assigned to the clinic. You go to the clinic. They give you your heroin there. You have to use it there. You're monitored by a nurse. You can't take it out with you. And then you leave and go to your job. Almost everyone gets a job. They're given support to find work, to find housing. And one of the fascinating things about that program is you can stay on that program as long as you want. They never pressure you to cut back or to come off. And yet almost everyone does cut back and come off eventually. And Rita Mangi, who's the psychiatrist, though, explained to me, well, it's because their lives get better, right? Like, they want to be present in their lives more. As you improve people's lives, they don't want to be out of it so much. And again, the results in Switzerland have been very striking. Massive fall in street crime. Nobody has died of an overdose on legal heroin. Violent heroin dealing ceased to exist. And Switzerland is a really conservative country, and yet 70% of people voted to keep heroin legal in Switzerland after they'd seen it, even though it was super controversial when they first did it, because they could just see the results. Mm. And it's interesting, if you think about that in relation to the UN system, Barry McCaffrey, who was Clinton's drug czar, turned up in Switzerland and wagged his finger and started berating the Swiss. And Ruth Dreyfus said, these aren't her exact words, I'm paraphrasing, but how dare you?
Right.
I'm the president of Switzerland, and my people voted for this in a referendum, and we are not a colony of the United States. But of course, Switzerland is in a very strong position to do that in a way that, say, Mexico or Jamaica or some of the other countries that get, or Guatemala, some of the other countries that are going to be speaking out at the UN next week are not in a position to do that. So in the same way that, I don't know, Donald Trump's son, I'm not accusing his son specifically, but if Donald Trump's son wanted to use drugs, I'm pretty sure he could do it with impunity in a way that, you know, a kid in Brownsville, Brooklyn can't. It's a similar kind of dynamic. If you are the cops, if you are the powerful, you can break it. And if you're not, you can't. And also, just to say one thing in relation to that very quickly is about, just to pick on what you mentioned, the US, of course, itself is now in breach of the conventions because you're not allowed to legalize the drug under the conventions. And yet Colorado, Washington, and Oregon have done that. So the US is going into this convention in a really weird position where they are one of the most hardline countries. They try to force it on other countries, and yet they are breaking that rule themselves.
It is also awkward, too, in the sense, I mean, the dynamic between the federal government and the states still continues to be, I mean, I think the federal government has basically said, we're not going to, and I don't know, to be honest with you, if this has been, I think this has been legislated where they basically said, we're not going to interfere. But at the very least, I know that it's an executive action. It could have been legislated at this point. I cannot remember what the outcome of it was.
Yeah, no, you're right. It hasn't been legislated yet, which is why you had people like Chris Christie, when he was running, saying, if I get in, I will go after the right. Colorado and Washington dispensaries. I mean, they're already in a very difficult position because in terms of the banking laws, even though you can legally do it, right. It's very hard to have a bank account even.
My sense is in Colorado, there isn't a single bank that will take money. And so you've got these cottage industries growing up where people are basically literally like renting out warehouses to store their cash that they're getting legally because there's no, they just can't, their company cannot deposit it. They can't get a bank account. And there's lawsuits, I think, against some of the regional Federal Reserve banks. But, you know, it occurs to me that this convention functions in the same way. I mean, the parallel that occurs to me is in the same way that the United States has is attempting through things like the TTIP and the TPP to impose its copyright regime and its essentially its copyright regime around the world. I mean, so that they can control the value of products made here. I mean, also, frankly, the patent regime in terms of drugs. Maybe a coincidence, maybe not, but it's the same type of thing, right? This becomes a means of leverage to enforce the laws here and the system that we have here.
I think there's something in that. I wouldn't want to take that too far, but I think there's something in that. I don't think it's the main thing driving the drug war, but I think there is something in that. And I always think there's this funny quote I keep thinking of as you're talking. When they were forcing all the other countries to fall in line from the 30s to the 50s, Harry Anslinger, the guy we were talking about, the inventor of the drug war, at one point, another representative of another country, I think it was Thailand, challenged him at the UN. So in fact, this would have been the last time there was a challenge until this week. He said, these were his exact words, "I've made up my mind, don't try to confuse me with the facts." Which to me could be like the perfect motto for the entire war on drugs.
I get phone calls actually like that on this program about a myriad of issues. So tell us about the other people who, that you spoke to who are going to be speaking at UNGAS and give us a sense of how you think it's going to go there. I mean, the hopes of reformers in terms of what comes out of UNGAS?
Yeah, so I'll give you two other examples just briefly. One is Mark Golding, who's the Justice Minister for Jamaica and an absolutely remarkable man. A couple of years ago, he had this moment that was a turning point for him. He made a call that no Justice Minister wants to have to make. He had to phone a mother and tell her that her young son had been picked up for smoking a spliff on the street and he had subsequently been beaten to death. And Mark had this kind of realization. He connects it to Black Lives Matter that, as we were saying before, the drug laws simply can't be enforced against everyone. So in every society, they end up being enforced against the most easy to pick on minority. In Jamaica, that's poor young men, obviously, in relation to Black Lives Matter. Almost everyone in Jamaica is black. But the, you know, in that society, it's the poorest people. And Mark went to the cabinet and basically said, look, we can't go on giving the police this license to harass poor young men. We have to do something. So they successfully decriminalized cannabis. Now, they haven't legalized because you're not allowed to do that. So under the UN conventions, you're allowed to have limited decriminalization for personal use, but you're not allowed to fully legalize. You're not allowed to do what Colorado's done with cannabis and what Switzerland's done with heroin. And Jamaica is much more vulnerable to US pressure and being accused of being a trafficking country and sanctions and all sorts of other things that could happen to them, just like happened to Colombia in the 80s. So they're not doing everything they want to do. They still have to go to war against, they still have to have this war between criminal gangs to control the trade, and they have to go to war, the state has to go to war against them. They have to go to war against the farmers who are growing it, that they're not happy. But so Mark is going to be speaking out, basically saying prohibition of cannabis is madness and the drug laws allow a licensing of poor people. From Colombia, I spoke to Mauricio Rodriguez in Cartagena in Colombia recently. He's a fascinating man. He's been involved in advising President Santos, who hopefully is going to be speaking out of the UNGAS. It's not clear whether the president himself will go, but hopefully he will. And, you know, I think they have a really profound moral authority. The country has been completely destroyed. It's hard to underestimate the scale of the horror that was inflicted upon the supply route countries. And, you know, people who want to understand that, I would just give them a very simple experiment that they can do. Your listeners can do it while they're listening to your podcast if they feel a bit brave. Go into a local liquor store and try to steal a bottle of vodka. If the people who run that store catch you, they'll call the cops and the cops will come and take you away. So that liquor store doesn't need to be violent. It doesn't need to be intimidating. They have the power of the law to uphold their property rights. Now try to go, unless you're in Colorado, Washington, or Oregon, try to steal not a bottle of vodka, but a bag of weed or a bag of coke. If the guy selling that catches you, obviously he can't ring the cops, right? The cops would come and arrest him. He has to fight you. Now, he doesn't want to be having a fight every day. So he's got to establish a reputation for being such a badass that no one will dare to take him on. I learned a lot of this from my friend Chino Hardin, the transgender crack dealer in Brownsville, Brooklyn, that I write about in Chasing the Scream. You've got to establish a reputation for being so friendly. You have to establish your place in the neighborhood as the dealer through violence. The war on drugs creates a war for drugs. Now, that plays out in the United States. Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize winning economist, I wouldn't normally quote him approvingly because I think he was a deeply evil man, but on this he was right. You know, calculated there are 10,000 additional murders every year in the United States as a result of that dynamic. Mm. Now, that, you look at all these killings that are happening in Chicago at the moment, that's overwhelmingly that dynamic. Often on the same corners where Al Capone's people were killing people during alcohol prohibition, just if you want some symbolic resonance. Now, that violence ends when you end prohibition, right? There are no violent heroin dealers in Switzerland now. So Mauricio, President Santos, and in fact the three countries that called for the UNGAS to happen a little bit early, Mexico, Colombia, and Guatemala, are going to be saying, look, this violence is destroying us. There's a great line David Simon, the creator of The Wire, said, you know, the United States is prepared to fight the drug war to the bones of the last Mexican.
Right.
And it does kind of feel like that to them. And if I think about the time I spent, particularly in northern Mexico, some of the stuff that I saw there and learned about there, I mean, that was, you know, I've been to some pretty awful places. I've been to Iraq, I've been to Gaza, I've been to the Congo. I have to say that the violence in northern Mexico is the people I met who were victims of that violence, that is the most brutal violence I've ever learned about and the most preventable. So that's what Mauricio would be talking about. But so in terms of what they're hoping for, I guess there's two things really. There's the kind of lowest goal, which is no one will ever be able to say again that the world is united behind this demand, right? That ends this week. They can never say that again. They're not asking for much. They're not saying the whole world should shift to the policy that they prefer. They're saying that countries should be allowed to choose the path for themselves that they think is best, rather than having this. We've had this straitjacket for all, you know, for a really long time, for more than 40 years, in practice for nearly 100 years. So what they're saying is two things: allow countries to experiment if they want to. And the second thing is they're arguing that we should set up, that the UN should set up a panel of experts, just leading experts on addiction, drug use, prohibition-related violence, all of the stuff we're talking about, to just prepare a report and report back to the UN in 2 years recommending evidence-based policies on drugs. And I think it's incredibly revealing that the prohibitionist countries, the countries that are leading the charge to maintain or intensify the drug war, are resisting that demand. It tells you something when people don't want to look at the facts. If they thought the facts were on their side,
right,
if they thought that what they were doing had good evidence, you know, why? I mean, if you asked me about, I don't know, should we set up a panel about global warming to look at the facts? I'd be like, yeah, damn right, you know, because I'm totally confident it would find the things that, you know, that you and I know about global warming and that, you know, right-wingers deny. It's revealing that they're not doing that.
Who are those countries? Who are the main impediments to reforming these policies and basically just allowing other countries to have authority, some type of sovereign authority to experiment and to change their policies?
It's a weird coalition. So the US is at the head of it still, despite Colorado, Washington, and despite the fact that huge majorities of people in the United States now agree the drug war has failed. The other are Russia. A few years ago, I met, very, very briefly met, Viktor Ivanov, the Russian drug czar, who is one of the most chilling and evil people I've ever met. China, Cuba, weirdly, Fidel Castro and his brother are the last remaining Reaganites in the Americas. I don't quite understand why. And Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, South Africa, and Southeast, some of the Southeast Asian countries like Thailand. Oh, sorry, one of the other really minimal demands that is being made at the UNGAS by the reform-related countries is to say, at the very least, we shouldn't be executing anyone anymore in relation to the drug trade. You know, a very large amount of the executions in Thailand and in China are you know, drug-related executions. Iran is the other one as well. So it's a kind of ugly coalition of authoritarians, dictatorships, religious fundamentalists, and the US for, you know.
I mean, what accounts for this coalition? I mean, do you think it's, I mean, if we carry out the analogy you made to, you know, someone on the Upper East Side using drugs and not having to pay a price, but you know, somebody caught with a joint in the Bronx ends up in jail, is it that these I guess anti-drug regimes offer a mechanism in which to crack down? I mean, Handelman. Who had conceded the other day, or maybe somebody had reported on an interview that they had had with him in the 90s, where he said, yeah, that whole war on drugs thing, that was just basically an excuse for us to marginalize hippies and black people. And that's where it basically came from. I mean, on some level, is that happening? Are the anti-drug regimes still being used, essentially, in that same manner, particularly by countries? I mean, I think we're on our last gasps here, at least for part of it in this country. But in a country like Russia and China, I mean, are these mechanisms in which to crack down on people who are usually either legitimately or illegitimately, but are associated with other activities that the government wants to intimidate and quash?
Yeah, if anyone wants to look up the quote you were just mentioning, it's in Dan Baum's piece in Harper's recently. He's actually reporting something that Ehrlichman said to him in the 90s, or maybe even the 80s. I think the Nixon administration, unsurprisingly, was unusually cynical I think for them it was, well, as they admitted, and there's that quote from Nixon, I think it might be on the White House tapes, where he says something like, it's all about the blacks. We can't say it's all about the blacks, but it's all about the blacks, about the war on drugs.
Right. I think that was Lee Atwater on his right. Deathbed, I think it was.
Oh, no. No, I know about the Atwater quote, but Nixon has a quote from that as well, quote like that as well. So there's some of them for whom it is consciously a pretext to crack down on minorities they otherwise want to persecute. To be fair to the people in favour of the drug war, I'm obviously strongly against. I don't think that is the conscious and deliberate reason. I don't think that's the primary reason. It's definitely a reason. I don't think it's the primary reason why they're doing it. I think there are several reasons, not all of which are, you know, inherently disreputable. So I think some reasons. One is there are problems caused by drugs. Now, the war on drugs makes all of them worse. But what's the best way to put this? It is an understandable reaction to look at the problems caused by drugs and to have a primitive feeling, which is we need to just get rid of these things.
Right.
I don't think that's an inherently evil emotion or feeling. I think it doesn't work, but I don't think it's inherently evil or wicked. And I don't think you even have to. I don't think you have to want to use it as a pretext to destroy minority groups to think that and to have that reflex. So I think it's partly that. I think it's also, you know, I think one of the reasons why the drug war is such a charged debate is actually because it runs through the hearts of all of us in a way that, for example, other debates that I care about and I know you care about, Sam, like equality for gay people, don't, right? Like that, there is a bit of all of us, particularly if you've, like, as you know, I had addiction in my family. If you think about addiction as just one example, it's not the only problem related with drugs. And I don't think it's primarily caused by drugs, as you know, but it's very natural human impulse. And I feel, even after all the research I've done and all I've learned, when I look at some of the people I love who have drug problems, there's still a bit of me that thinks, I wish someone would stop you. I wish someone would make this drug disappear. Even though I know rationally that's failed, it's not the answer, that's actually not the core of the problem. So I think there's a degree to which, and certainly when you look at the issue of children using drugs, that it's not inherently wicked to say we need to make these substances disappear. Now, it doesn't work. It actually makes it easier for kids to get drugs. I can explain why if you want.
It's just an unsophisticated response in some instances.
I think so. And the other thing, this is more pretentious than I would have put it in Chasing the Scream, but I also think if you think about the drug war in the long arc of human history, I think it belongs in the history of symbolic wars. If you think about it, there's a great book called, there's a great book that was written in the 19th century called Passing Frenzy. It'll come back to me in a second, but it's a fantastic history of symbolic wars. It was written in the 19th century. It looked at things like the Crusades, the witchcraft hunts. What they are, you can think of it by a modern American analogy, right? You think about every now and then it happens that an evangelical preacher, a homophobic evangelical preacher, is caught in bed with a rent boy or having sex with a man. And people say that's hypocrisy. And they say, look at this hypocrite. And I always think, no, you're missing the point if you call that hypocrisy. What this man is doing when he's raging against gays in the world is he's turning this fear he has about himself,
yes,
projecting it onto an external object and thinking, if only you got rid of this external object, you would get rid of this thing in myself that I don't like. And I think a similar thing is happening with the war on drugs. We are all vulnerable to addictive impulses to some degree. We are all vulnerable to the temptation to intoxicate ourselves too much. Obviously, as our social circumstances change, some of us become more or less vulnerable. But that is there for all of us. And it's very tempting when you confront that in yourself to say, destroy the object in the world. You know, if you look at the fears that were projected onto witches, that they were obsessed with sex at a time when society, when you had to really repress your own sexuality, that's why witches had broomsticks, right? It's like a phallic object between their legs. That's what the projected fear was. If you think about so many symbolic fears, they're like that. So I think it's, again, I wouldn't want to overstate it. I don't think that's the main reason. But I do think one of the reasons why this happens in so many different places is because it is a natural human impulse to externalize your fear and try to destroy it, and also to rally around an enemy and to go, look, here's this thing we all agree is wicked and evil. Let's rally together and wage war on it. And of course, war is, what's it, Randolph Bourne said, you know, war is the power of the state. I forget the exact phrase, you know, obviously it enhances state power to take money, to wage war, to surveil the population, all of those things as well.
All right. Well, so Johan, we just got a couple of minutes here. But what can people do at this point?
more than any other issue I can think of, this is something where banding together and demanding change will save enormous number of people's lives. I tell the story in Chasing the Scream of a homeless street addict in Vancouver called Bud Osborne, about the bravest person I ever met, who started an uprising in Vancouver that transformed the laws of Canada and led to the first injecting room, a Supreme Court ruling saying addicts have a right to life and a safe place to use drugs, that's transformed Canada and saved thousands of people's lives. There are so many fantastic organizations that people can join in the US that are winning. You are joining the winning side. And every day more people join that fight, the sooner the war will end and the more people's lives will save. So on the book's website, it's www.chasingthescream.com. I've got a list of organizations in the US that people can join. I would urge them to join the Drug Policy Alliance in particular, a fantastic group, but there's a list of, there's some amazing activism going on around this. There's so much low-hanging fruit. There's obviously the big goal of getting towards, you know, a regulated market with love and compassion for addicts, but there's low-hanging fruit that will save huge numbers of people's lives, things that can be achieved very rapidly, like Good Samaritan law. It just got loads of overdose deaths in the US are the result of the fact that if someone is overdosing, people don't call an ambulance because they're worried that they'll be arrested or even charged with manslaughter or murder, which has happened to lots of people, if they use drugs or provided the drugs. Good Samaritan law is a really simple law, just says if you are ever with a person who's overdosing and you call for an ambulance, we won't search you to see if you're using drugs or have drugs on you. It massively reduces death from overdose. It's only happened in a few states so far. Look up whether there's one in your state. If there isn't, organize a campaign. It won't take much fighting. It's very hard for anyone to oppose a Good Samaritan law. That alone will save thousands of your fellow citizens. So there's a huge amount that people can do. And of course, that then gets momentum going for much wider and deeper changes as well. This does not have to be happening. There are some intractable problems in the world. There are some tragedies we can't solve. I'm not saying that the solutions solve all the problems. They certainly don't. But, you know, Portugal decriminalized all drugs. They transferred the money to turning addicts' lives around. And injecting drug use fell by 50%, 50%. Wow. I reported on that for my book. I went to see it. It's an incredible thing to see. You know, we can save an enormous number of people's lives with a relatively minor change. There aren't that many policies that you can say that about. And the tide is turning. Things are changing. You can be part of that tide. It depends on whether we organize and demand it. If we organize and demand it, this war will end. If we don't, it will just carry on and carry on. And we'll be looking back in another 100 years saying, you know, these people did not have to die.
The book is Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. Johan Hari, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And UNGAS starts next week in New York. Thanks again, Johan.
Oh, it's totally my pleasure. Thank you so much, Sam.